Good afternoon, and welcome to the September meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine, the summit of Point Lookout, in fact. And a particularly warm welcome to our Midcoast radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the president of the forum, which was founded in 1983. For nearly 32 years, that's over 375 meetings, the forum has been gathering on a monthly basis to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen, journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Now today, we're delighted to have as our speaker, Gareth Porter, an American historian, investigative journalist, author, and policy analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. Gareth has written several books about the potential for peaceful conflict resolution in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, including his 2005 book, Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power and the Road to War in Vietnam, an analysis of how and why the United States went to war in Vietnam. In 2012, he was the winner of the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, awarded annually to acknowledge reporting that exposes propaganda. His most recent book is Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, which came out in February of 2014. So, Gareth, we're delighted to have you today. His topic is, was the Iran nuclear crisis necessary?
Thank you. My topic, as has already been mentioned, is, was the Iran nuclear crisis necessary? I can relieve you of your anxiety about what the answer is very quickly by saying the answer is no, it was not. That is the burden of the book that you see outside, the book that was published about a year and a half ago now, called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. That book was the result of really several years of reporting and 1 year or so of very intense research going beyond what I had learned from about 2006 on in my reporting on the Iran nuclear issue. And without going into detail, because we don't have time for sort of storytelling, a personal storytelling about this, the reason that I ended up writing this book was that I learned around 2007, 2008, that what I thought was true about the Iran nuclear issue was not true at all. And the deeper I got into the facts about the history of the Iranian nuclear program and about the policies of the United States and its allies, its European allies, toward this issue, and the role of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, the more I understood that I had been deceived and that the American public and the world's publics had been deceived about this very vitally important issue. And so I ended up really delving into this issue, I think I can say with utmost confidence, far more deeply than anyone else in the news media or in academia in the world. And I can tell you, my book was translated into Persian last year, and so I was in Tehran for the launching of the Persian language version of my book. And since then, starting on that occasion, I learned that the Iranians really learned a lot from my book that they didn't know themselves, which is really quite remarkable. What I want to do very briefly is to take you back to the beginning of this issue of the Iran nuclear program, and just to take you through the key points that I learned in the process of writing this book. Because what you have to understand is that the entire history of the Iranian nuclear program has been misrepresented by the official line taken by the Bush, well, by the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations. And that what has been represented as an interest in nuclear weapons on the part of the Islamic Republic of Iran from the beginning of their nuclear program is in fact a complete fiction. The fact is that when this new government was formed in 1979, the Iranian government was really not interested in what the Shah had done with the full cooperation of the United States, having an extremely ambitious nuclear program. True, they only had one nuclear reactor at Bushehr, but there were plans for many reactors in the future. And the Shah, you know, indeed was viewing Iran as not a nuclear weapons power, but a major nuclear country with a very ambitious nuclear program. The Islamic Revolution, on the other hand, of course, was very skeptical about this project, which was viewed, understandably, as something that represented the combination of the Shah's power, on one hand, and the power of the United States, this imperialist power, which had intervened for many years in Iran, in ways that, of course, the new government was very unhappy with. So they basically, they didn't dismantle this program completely, but they clearly downgraded it very sharply. The number of technicians, the number of scientists and engineers who were employed in the program was dramatically reduced. And they continued the program then. Beginning in 1983, Iran approached the IAEA and asked it to help Iran to rebuild its program, you know, over a long period of time. But the most important thing to understand about this was that when they approached the IAEA, it was on the basis that Iran was not planning to enrich uranium itself. It was going to rely on a consortium, an international consortium, which was based in France, in which the Shah had actually a 10% stake, and that is a financial stake, and thus was entitled to 10% of the enriched uranium that was produced by that consortium. And that was going to provide the atomic fuel, the nuclear fuel, for Bushehr nuclear reactor, for electric power for Iran. But what happened then, and I'm going to try to shorten this story to get to the point, is that the Reagan administration during the Iran-Iraq war was supporting Iraq's attack on Iran and was very much afraid of Iran being victorious in that war and upsetting the balance of power in the Middle East. And of course, that was also a time when the United States was very, very much hostile to this Islamic Republic that had been formed. And so what the Reagan administration did was to put pressure on both Germany and France to stop any cooperation with Iran's nuclear program. That meant, fundamentally, Iran could not get its stake of the consortium's enriched uranium to use as fuel for Bushehr. It also meant that they couldn't rebuild the Bushehr reactor with the help of Germany, with the help of a German corporation, which had promised to do so. Again, both France and Germany, French and German governments, under pressure from the United States, essentially terminated all cooperation with the Iranian nuclear program. What did that mean? Historically, it was extremely important because that meant that the Iranian government had two choices, either to bow down to the diktat of Washington, of the Reagan administration, that it not have its own nuclear program, a peaceful nuclear program for electrical power, or to obtain the independent capability to enrich uranium on the black market, because they would not be able to get the technology to do so through the normal commercial channels, which were being shut down by the United States and its European allies. Well, you can guess which choice the Iranian government made. Obviously, they chose the path of an independent capability to enrich uranium. And so beginning in the mid-1980s, Iran began to approach the black market for nuclear technology, which soon meant that they were dealing with people who were in touch with A.Q. Khan, the notorious Pakistani scientist who was peddling not just nuclear technology, but in some cases, trying to peddle plans for nuclear weapons to states that did not have that technology. And indeed, this A.Q. Khan network tried to interest the Iranians in having the technology to produce nuclear weapons, but the Iranians said no, they weren't interested. They were only interested in getting the blueprints for the centrifuges that they could use to enrich uranium. And that's exactly what they did. So, fast forward a few years, the Clinton administration, when it came into office, was very much determined to have a policy in the Middle East that would be supportive completely of the policy that the Israelis were adopting toward Iran. At that point, the government, the labor government of Yitzhak Rabin, was primarily concerned with negotiating with the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization. It was his view that that was the best course for Israel. And the politics were such in Israel at that point. We're talking about the early 1990s, 1993 and forward. Politics in Israel were such that that was a very unpopular policy for him to put forward. And so in order to sell that policy to the Israeli voters, Rabin made the argument that we have a new enemy on the horizon, and it's called Iran. Iran is a terrorist state. It's determined to destabilize the Middle East, and it wants nuclear weapons. And he sold that idea. He got the Clinton administration to adopt that idea, and so the Clinton administration soon began to attack Iran's intentions, nuclear intentions, saying that the United States had evidence, intelligence, that Iran was trying to get nuclear weapons. Well, they had no such thing. I can tell you that there was no such intelligence. The fact is, and this is based on a former national intelligence officer, Paul Pillar, who I interviewed several times for my book, his view based on the knowledge of the record of U.S. intelligence beginning in the 1990s is that there was no human intelligence, there was no electronic intelligence indicating that Iran had any intention to get nuclear weapons. This was all an inference. It was an inference from the fact that Iran wanted to get the technology to enrich uranium. And that is the foundation, ladies and gentlemen, of the position that has been taken by the U.S. government ever since. This was the basis for the Bush administration line, which took the form of national intelligence estimates, as well as public pronouncements by Bush administration officials that Iran wants nuclear weapons. They did not have any hard intelligence to support that at all. Furthermore, in my book, I have a subchapter which tells the story, and I'll try to get this very quickly because there's so much more to talk about a covert CIA operative who was in charge of developing human sources of intelligence on nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction in both Iran and Iraq. And he did, in fact, succeed in developing those human intelligence sources. And in 2001, one of his sources on Iran told him that Iran has no intention of weaponizing the enriched uranium that it is planning to accumulate. This was the first human intelligence from a reliable source, a source that had been vetted. It was agreed that this was a respected source. We don't know who it was, never been named, obviously, but it was a respected human intelligence source saying for the first time, Iran has no intention of weaponizing. What happened to that intelligence? The head of covert operations, the head of operations in the CIA, sat on that intelligence, would not allow it to be circulated within the US government, not even within the analytical community of the CIA. And so that intelligence was never made available to those people who did the 2001 NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, the 2005 National Intelligence Estimate, and the 2007 National Intelligence Estimate. And it is my view, and I've finished an article that has not been published yet, in which I tell this story, that the action, the intervention by a senior official of the CIA to prevent this intelligence from being circulated. And this story came out because the CIA covert operative sued the CIA for wrongful treatment, and finally for being fired by the CIA for having put forward intelligence that the brass in Langley did not like. And that's how we know about this. It was only because his lawyer told me this in 2012 that I was able to tell finally this story for the first time. So the significance of all this is the following, that for 20 years, the US government was putting out a line politically and in terms of its intelligence, which was based on a false premise, and indeed based on deception on the part of high-ranking officials in the CIA. George Tenet had to be witting to this intervention because the head of CIA operations at that point was very, very close to George Tenet. The day George Tenet submitted his resignation in June of 2004, 24 hours later, the head of operations submitted his resignation, announced that he was resigning. That's how close they were. So I think it's very important to understand just how completely the US government went off the tracks from the very beginning and never got back on track to accurately understand and to portray the Iranian nuclear program. And, you know, I go into another set of stories in my book about how the Bush administration worked closely with Israel to present a case to the world's publics, including the American people, that Iran had in fact worked on nuclear weapons, had an active nuclear weapons program, research program, and that the Iranian people who were working on that, one of the Iranian engineers working on it, had escaped from Iran with documents that showed, that proved that Iran had this nuclear weapons research program. I show in my book that the origins of those documents, the so-called laptop documents, which first materialized supposedly in 2004, were actually They came into the hands of Western intelligence because they were delivered by a member of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. Now, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq is not just any Iranian organization. It's an Iranian armed opposition group which had been pushed out of Iran in the 1980s and had been working for Saddam Hussein, carrying out armed opposition to the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war. And then, when that war was over, hitched their wagon to Israel, to Mossad, and had become a client for the International Intelligence Organization service of Israel, the Mossad. I can't go into the details here, but I will tell you that there's very strong evidence that these documents were not just turned over by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, which was also listed as a terrorist organization by the State Department until 2 years ago, when they were bought off the list by a very well-financed political campaign, which, you know, bought off a number of political figures in both Republican and Democratic parties, but they were considered a terrorist organization for various reasons, including the fact that they killed American officials in both Iran and elsewhere. They were not only turned over to German intelligence by the MEK, but there's very strong evidence that they came from Mossad originally. Indeed, there's a book that was published in Hebrew about the most successful covert operations of Mossad over the years, which included those documents as one of the covert operations that Mossad had been successful at. Now, the source, to be honest, did not say that those documents were false, were falsified documents. But in my book, I show that there are a number of anomalies, including a large number of technical errors, technical mistakes in the key documents, which showed that this was not, in fact, an Iranian first team of engineers and scientists who made these documents. These documents were fabricated by people who did not really know the Iranian missile program, as I show in my book. So I don't want to go any further in sort of putting out the evidence to you for my thesis that this was an unnecessary manufactured crisis. What I want to say now is that the agreement that's been reached between the United States and Iran, and I was in Vienna for the final 2 weeks, 2 weeks plus, of those negotiations. I had access, unique access, to the Iranian diplomats who were part of the Iranian negotiating team. Two officials who were part of that team met with me, I think 9 or 10 times during the 14 days that I was there. And I've been able to produce a very detailed account of how the US and Iran finally reached an agreement after 18 months of negotiations. It's published in The Nation magazine online. So if you're interested in really getting the inside dope, I suggest that article to you as a unique source of insight into how those negotiations were completed. I think the key point is that the Obama administration has both oversold and undersold this agreement. They've oversold it in the following sense, that they have tried to convince the American public that if it were not for the clever diplomacy backed by the threat of force and other pressures waged by the Obama administration, certainly the Iranians would have gotten nuclear weapons, or they would be well on their way to get nuclear weapons. That, of course, is a complete falsehood. The reality of the situation over the last several years is that the Iranians were angling for a negotiated settlement with the Obama administration beginning in 2011, when they added 20,000 more centrifuges to the existing number of centrifuges that they had. I'm sorry, 10,000 more centrifuges to the existing number of centrifuges they had, but did not hook them up, did not put them into activity. Now, why did they do that? For the next several years, they didn't use the 10,000 or so centrifuges that they had installed in Natanz and in Fordo. The reason is very clear, and the Obama administration understood this at the time. There's a newspaper article in the New York Times which actually quotes an Obama administration as acknowledging that they understood that the reason was that the Iranians intended to bargain with these centrifuges so that they could get the United States to reach an agreement with them to lift the sanctions. Now, in 2011, bear in mind that the crippling sanctions on oil and finance were not yet in place. They were still a glimmer in the eye of the Israelis at that moment. So it was not that they were bargaining with the United States to remove sanctions on oil. It was to remove the original sanctions which were imposed in 1995. The trade sanctions, which completely exclude the possibility of any trade between American companies and Iran. So, in other words, what the Iranians really wanted all along was to reach a negotiated agreement in which they would promise to reduce the footprint of their nuclear program in return for the United States lifting sanctions. That's a simplified version, but I think this is what can be very clearly documented on the public record. So in that sense, it's being oversold to the American people in the sense that the Obama administration is trying to suggest that if it weren't for their pressure on Iran, which by the way took the form not only of telling the Iranians that if they don't really come around and give up their enrichment, that the Israelis will certainly attack them and there's nothing we can do as Americans, we can't control the Israelis, right? That was part of the pressure on them. Another part of it was cyber attacks, not just on Natanz, but in 2012, a cyber attack on the oil and gas industry of Iran, which is very poorly documented, but it is documented. We know about this. And then the third form of pressure, of course, was the threat and finally the reality of these crippling sanctions on the Iranian economy. So it's been oversold in that sense. It's being undersold in the sense that the Obama administration is failing to tell the American people the truth that the Iranians really have been trying to get an agreement with the United States for many, many years, going back all the way to the 1980s. It's 1989. And I tell this story in my book because it's a big turning point from 1989 to 1992. This was when there was a real opportunity for the United States to end the hostility between these two countries, the hostility between the United States and Iran, because the president, the then president of Iran, the former the guy who was the head of the political faction, which was clearly identified as wanting to open up the Iranian economy to the West. And so when he was elected president in 1989, it was the opportunity of a lifetime. And he offered to help free U.S. prisoners, U.S. hostages in Lebanon, as President Bush at that time had requested Iran to do. And of course, in return, Bush had promised in his opening address as president, his inaugural address as president, that he would reciprocate in some fashion. He didn't say how. So when the Iranians did that, helped to release those hostages, they expected the U.S. government to reciprocate in some fashion, to at least reduce significantly the sanctions against Iran, to make a major move symbolically to reciprocate. Well, you know, the fact is that the White House really wanted to do that. They were seriously thinking about ways that they could reciprocate in 1991-92. But Robert M. Gates became the CIA director in November 1991, and he was dead set against that. And in my book, I speculate maybe it was because his whole career was endangered by the Iran-Contra affair, in which he was burned because he went along with the scheme that had been cooked up by the head of the CIA and others to basically have a trade in which, you know the story of Iran-Contra, I won't go into that. But he had been part of that caper, that part of that scheme, and he didn't tell the truth about it when his name was submitted to become director of CIA, and he almost was basically lost his career completely. And he blamed the president of Iran at that point for having made public the fact that the U.S. had sent this team secretly to Iran as part of the deal. And so he always made fun of the idea that there was such a thing as an Iranian moderate. He said, the only Iranian moderates are those people who are dead. And this was told to me by one of the national intelligence officers who worked on the Middle East. And so it appears that he personally sabotaged this opening to Iran in 1991-92. And as a result of that, this opportunity was not taken advantage of, and the rest is history. So my problem with the stance of the Obama administration is that they've really not been telling the truth to the American people about this. I'm happy that we have this agreement, believe me. And I'm worried about what happens if a Republican gets into the Oval Office, because then we're in an entirely new ballgame. We can't predict what would happen, and it's extremely dangerous, to say the least. So now, I think I've probably run out of time, and I want to just say a few words about how I think the United States should be taking advantage of this opening to Iran to address the mess that we now have in the Middle East, and why they aren't doing it. So the point here is that the United States is in a situation where everything's falling apart. The Middle East is suffering the greatest amount of destabilization that it has in 100 years, ever since the First World War, the end of the First World War, and the international boundaries that were drawn after that war by the colonial powers in the Middle East. We've never had anything like the destabilization that we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years. And of course, single biggest cause of this, unquestionably, the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the occupation of Iraq, which unleashed the forces of jihadism into the rest of the Middle East, because of course it is in Iraq where Al-Qaeda got a foothold for the first time. It was that foothold that then became the basis for ISIS, for the Islamic State. They then moved from Iraq into Syria and then became the primary threat of jihadism in the Middle East. And we now have a situation where, of course, both Iraq and Syria essentially are no longer nation states. They've been broken up de facto into sub-states, into smaller enclaves, which represent different ethnic groups who hold power and who have their own armies. And the same thing is true in Iraq and in Syria. And the question is really whether the Islamic State is going to continue to gain more power and more territory, or whether it will continue to hold on to what it has already. That's not a very appealing choice But this is really what the choice that U.S. policy faces. And at this point, I make this statement without any fear of contradiction. The Obama administration has not the slightest idea of how it can either stop ISIS in its tracks, much less reduce its power in the future. The wars that the United States are waging in Iraq and in Syria are clearly not having any decisive effect. This is acknowledged clearly by the U.S. military itself, even though we know that the brass at CENTCOM are trying to doctor up the intelligence reporting on this to make it look like they're more successful than they really are. But the reality is that they don't have a clue about how to affect this fundamental problem. And underlying that reality is that the United States is deeply enmeshed in an alliance structure in which all of our allies, the Israelis, the Saudis, Turks, the GCC, and the other GCC members, none of them are fundamentally committed to the defeat of ISIS. None of them are fundamentally committed to the defeat of the Al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. None of them are fundamentally committed to the defeat of Al-Qaeda or ISIS in Yemen. We now have a situation where Al-Qaeda has achieved a foothold in Yemen, an ungoverned space where they essentially hold power for the first time. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is what it's now called, is the gravest danger to organize a plot against the United States homeland or against Europe, anywhere in the world. All of that is a result of U.S. policy and of Saudi policy. So the United States being enmeshed in this alliance structure, which is essentially in favor of the status quo, rather than trying to sort out a way to reduce the power of ISIS and of Al-Qaeda, this is an extremely dangerous situation. There's only one state in the Middle East that is committed to the same, at least avowed end or objective as the United States, which is to counter the terrorism of ISIS and of Al-Qaeda. That state is not Israel. That state is Iran. The Israelis actually regard Iran as the great danger, much greater danger than ISIS, and they've said so publicly. So we have a fundamental problem with our alliance choices in the Middle East. And I'm ready to say that either the United States must fundamentally alter, totally change its alliance structure in the Middle East, or it should get out of the Middle East entirely. I think that's probably provocative enough to end my talk on in order to get you going. Thank you very much.
Well, Gareth, that's certainly food for thought. Okay, here's the first question. Going forward, if Iran has no interest in developing a nuclear weapon, do we need to be concerned whether or not they cheat on the agreement?
I think that one is very easy to answer, and the answer is no. I mean, the Iranians have absolutely no interest whatever in cheating on this agreement. This would be the stupidest move that any state in these circumstances could make, for a whole series of reasons. I mean, I could go into those, but I assume that's really not necessary to do that. I mean, the basic reason is that cheating cannot succeed. It will be detected. The IAEA has the capability to detect a particle of uranium as small as 1/1,000,000,000th of a gram, okay? And that evidence cannot be hidden, it cannot be washed away, it cannot be painted off, painted over. There is no way to cheat, my friends. That's why that's so stupid. And if there's one thing the Iranians are not, it is stupid.
Okay, here's another one. In your judgment, how significant has Israel's role been in shaping U.S. policy regarding the Iranian nuclear program? And a related question, how does it benefit Israel today to exaggerate the threat from Iran?
Now, that's a very good set of questions. Had I had unlimited time, I, of course, would have talked about that in the course of trying to round up the reasons why this crisis was not necessary. The Israelis played a crucial role in the formation, in the creation of this crisis. They did so with the close cooperation of the neoconservatives in the Bush administration. There are two figures primarily who were very close to the Israelis in the Bush administration, two officials. One is very well known, John Bolton. You all know that name. If you ever watch Fox News, perish the thought. I know you see John Bolton frequently. Bolton, of course, was the policymaker of the State Department on WMD. He was also the policymaker on Iran, and he was the primary point of contact with Israel. He took frequent trips to Israel. We know, as a matter of public record, because it came out when he was nominated to be the ambassador to the United Nations in 2005, that his trips to Israel were not authorized by the State Department, by the Bureau of the State Department, which had responsibility for the Middle East. That is fundamental procedure for all State Department trips. Any State Department official who travels must have the approval of the relevant bureau, the geographical bureau, for that trip. He did not get the authorization. He went anyway. He met with the head of Mossad on at least one of those, and I suspect even more than one. There is no record, as there normally is, for all meetings between a senior State Department official and officials of a foreign government. Because it was not authorized, there's no record. There was no cable sent back, no diplomatic cable was sent back on what was said between Bolton and the head of Mossad. That is why I believe that what they cooked up was a plan which involved the laptop documents. A plan that would establish the theme that the Bush administration later did establish through the IAEA, that Iran had, in fact, carried out a nuclear weapons research program. That's what these documents were about. That's the story that I tell in my book about the role that Bolton played in conjunction with Israel. The other official who was extremely important in this relationship was the Middle East advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney. David Wormser was his name. He was one of the co-authors of the infamous paper that was written for the newly elected Prime Minister of Israel in 1996 named Benjamin Netanyahu. It was a paper that advocated Israel overthrowing the government of Syria by force, Iraq as well to come, the ultimate prize to be Iran. And David Wormser had the ear of Dick Cheney. He was the one who was pushing for war with Iran at that point. And there's no question that John Bolton was taking his cues from Dick Cheney. Cheney was the one who was telling him, this is what we're going to do on Iran. And so there was, in fact, a policy that was aimed, and by the way, Bolton in his memoirs hints very strongly that this is the case, to establish a record that would allow the United States to go to the UN Security Council to accuse Iran of having a nuclear weapons program, and then either get the support of the Security Council for whatever action the United States would be ready to take, or if they didn't get that, simply go ahead on the basis that they had checked off all the boxes and now they could use force whenever it was necessary. So that's the story in a short form.
Okay, how about this? What should the U.S., what can the U.S. do to help what you call the worst crisis in the modern Middle East? And a related question, which proposes an answer. Why not pull out of the Middle East entirely?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a way, you know, there's an answer to that question, which in a way combines the two alternatives. And I think that is the following. And if I were in charge of the U.S. government, if I were president of the United States, this is what I would be coming to the American people and saying, this is what we're going to do. We have discovered that the alliance structure which we have created over the years, which involves Saudi Arabia, Israel, the GCC, that is Qatar, UAE, Kuwait, and Turkey. Did I mention Israel already?
Yes.
I did. The problem with this alliance structure is that we have found that, you know, there are too many vested interests here in the status quo, and the status quo is going fundamentally in the wrong direction in the Middle East. We can no longer abide this, and therefore, you know, we are pulling our bases out of the Middle East. Those bases, of course, are all in countries that are part of that alliance structure, goes without saying. And we understand, this is the president speaking now, we understand that those bases no longer serve our interests because the only thing they can do is intervene in wars that are hopeless. They cannot possibly succeed. They cannot support the real interests of the United States, and therefore we are getting out of our bases. We are pulling out of our alliances, and we are going to assume the following posture, that we will use all of the influence that we have through our economic clout in the world to bring together Sunni and Shia factions in the Middle East, because fundamentally what has happened is that the Saudis have gone on a rampage on the basis that they claim they're afraid of the Shia power on their doorstep in Yemen and in Syria and in Iraq. And so they've become very aggressive militarily, as well as in terms of using their money to support the forces that oppose the Shia. Well, those forces are often people who are either terrorists themselves or who are supporting terrorists. And therefore, we're going to have to reorient. We're going to have to use our influence to try to reorient our erstwhile allies to come up, go in a different direction, to begin to talk peace with one another. That's the only way we're going to move away from the terrible direction that the Middle East has been taking. So this is what we're going to have to do in order to support the real interests of the United States in this part of the world, because it's become very clear that the course that we're on today is disastrous in every possible meaning of that word. Disastrous in terms of the threat of terrorism, disastrous in terms of the likelihood that we will be plunged into future wars in the region that will not be in our interests, disastrous in the sense that we alienate more and more people in every country in the Middle East, and therefore it's time for a change.
Okay, here a bunch of questions related to Iranian U.S. relations. Is it possible for Iran and U.S. ever to become friends? After all, they have some common interests like ISIS. Here's a related one. How do you assess the balance of competing forces in Iran between moderate and hardliners as it bears on U.S.-Iranian relations in the near term? And finally, do you see any evidence of back-channel negotiations going on now between Iran and the U.S.?
All great questions, just the right questions to ask. The first one on what, let's see, which one was the first one?
It was, is it possible for Iran and U.S. ever to become good friends, considering that we have ISIS and
Iran? I have written extensively on this, actually, and my analysis is that this cannot happen as long as the national security state, as we now see it, organized, continues to exist. And that's because you have such powerful bureaucratic interests in the Pentagon, in the CIA, in the NSA, in extremely close relations with the Saudis in particular, and with GCC states secondarily. Why is that? There's a whole series of reasons. Start with the Pentagon, of course. They are the big ticket part of the national security state. What is the largest single research and development project that the Pentagon has had in its budget over the last 15 to 20 years? Anybody know? Care to guess, just off the top of your head? What's the biggest R&D program over all the last two decades? It's missile defense, missile defense system. This has been the wet dream of the Pentagon and of the military services who are involved in it, and of the contractors who are all the major arms makers have a stake in the missile defense system, the anti-missile system that has been the biggest research and development program all this time. It's still going on. It's still worth billions of dollars in the budget every year, and that money is all going basically to arms manufacturers who, you know, hire the people who are making the decisions in the Pentagon. So this is a system that is a very powerful predictor of policy. That is extremely important on Iran policy. Why? Because you cannot justify a missile defense system, certainly in the Middle East. You can't justify it with regard to the United States homeland without regarding Iran as the primary threat. Just a few months ago, in June, or was it July? It was July. It was in July that the new Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, as I recall, was asked a question about Iran and started talking about how we don't want the Iranians to have an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile. Why did he say something like that? The Iranians have never had an ICBM. They've had no plans for an ICBM. Well, he says that because that is the rationale for the missile defense system. Without that rationale, it falls apart. So that's just a sample. I won't go any further than that.
Okay, we're going to go back into history a little bit. In the early 90s, you were talking about Rabin. Isn't part of what Rabin asserted actually true? Doesn't Iran, in fact, want to destabilize the Middle East? At least the Arab Middle East.
No. The Iranians have never been interested in destabilizing the Arab Middle East. The exception to that could be said to be Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War. Obviously, you know, they were actively involved in a war with Iraq, and at that point, they were supporting the Shia. And you could argue that before Iraq attacked Iran, they were already supporting the Shia, who were trying to overthrow the regime. Okay, I'll take that point. But in Syria, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in what have I missed? Anyway, throughout the rest of the Arab Middle East, the Iranian aim has not been to destabilize Arab countries. It has been to win over the rank and file, the Arab street, if you will, in a situation where the Sunni regimes in all of the Sunni countries of the Middle East, Sunni majority countries, have been hostile in one way or another to Iran. How have they done that? They've done that by taking the most pro-Palestinian position of any country outside Palestinian territory in the Middle East. The pro-Palestinian position of Iran has been its primary way of trying to win friends and influence people in the Arab Middle East. So without going into more detail, I would tell you without any fear of contradiction on the facts that it is not true that Iran has been trying to destabilize the Middle East. Khobar Towers bombing, fiction that Iran was involved in it, that was one of the things that I've investigated and found out that is simply not true.
Okay, unfortunately, we've gone way over time, but here's the last question. What is your solution for what appears to be, now maybe it's all changed since 2004, but what appears to be the politicization of the CIA, that is the utter manipulation of facts to serve political and perhaps corporate interests? Or perhaps the good news is that that's not happening anymore.
Yeah, there's no good news. I can guarantee you that. I don't know what the answer to politicization is. I know how and why it happened, but it's a very long-term thing. I mean, it goes back many years. The worst politicization, of course, happened when Robert M. Gates became deputy director of the CIA in the Reagan administration. And that was when you began to have a systematic trend towards hiring people or having people that you already hired commit themselves, and these are people who are in charge of various bureaus, geographical and other bureaus of the analytical branch of the CIA, committing them to ensuring that the analysts support the policy. They don't come up with analysis that's going to challenge the policy that the White House has put forward. And that unfortunately, that position, that notion was ensconced. It became more deeply enmeshed in the CIA's work for the next generation, really. And it still exerts a lot of influence even now. But the Bush administration added to that in its own way, the politicization pressure from the vice president's office in particular on Iraq and on Iran as well, no question about it. It's still a problem today. It's a problem because analysts who want to get ahead inevitably are looking for ways in which they can please their superiors, and more often than not, they believe that they're going to please their superiors by supporting certain lines of analysis that they know are already the line being taken by the agency. So it's a self-perpetuating problem in a way, and I don't really know how you get away from it.
Well, on that somewhat dreary note, Gareth, thank you very much. It's been very enlightening, very interesting, and as you can see, we've got a whole bunch of questions that unfortunately we don't have time for, but what we do have time for is to present you with the famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug, which I hope you will take with you on your next trip to Iran, because there are plenty of them in Washington, but I don't think anybody in Iran has ever seen it.
Thank you very much, Mac. Thank you very much indeed.